You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. I'm Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Nern, Chief Creative Officer. How's it going, Michael?
Pretty good. It's very hot still.
Yeah, again.
Winter has not yet arrived in Canada.
It has not. So do you want to do any follow-up from last week's episode? Anything somewhat related?
There are a few related things. I mean, like, as we speak, Uber is attempting to deploy self-driving cars. Various patents keep cropping up. It's constantly moving forward. Volkswagen actually just announced that they are prepping a electric car for 2019 that will go 300 miles on, wait for it, a 15-minute charge.
A 15-minute charge sounds technologically impossible.
Well, I think they're partnered with Tesla, and I think they're maybe taking advantage of the Tesla supercharger technology. They may have actually improved on it. That might explain why they're able to claim that. Because the supercharger tech will be a lot better by then. There have been various breakthroughs in battery technology for fast charging. Supercapacitors, that kind of thing. There are working prototypes at MIT and various other institutions around the world where they've made batteries that are capable of going to 100% in like 5 seconds.
Now, I thought Tesla was leading the way on the battery design. Are they not designing the batteries? Are they just buying them?
They're designing batteries, but they're still working with lithium ion. And the thing about Tesla is, it's not so much the design of the battery as bringing the cost of the battery down. Because we're not talking the kind of battery that lives in your smartphone. We're talking a battery the size of a coffee table. Or bigger. So they actually just launched, it's not running at full capacity or anything, but they opened their Gigafactory, which is the largest industrial factory on the face of the earth. It's something insane, like 50 football fields or maybe even bigger than that. It's huge. You could compare it to a small town in size. And it does one thing, and that is mass production of batteries. So through that, they're hoping to bring the cost of batteries down so far that electric cars will effectively become instantly possible for everybody.
That would be nice.
Because the batteries right now are one of the most expensive components. So if you bring that price down, then we can start looking at $10,000 electric vehicles with comparable ranges to existing Tesla cars.
And of course, the price of this stuff is going to go down.
Yeah. As this technology continues to be developed, prices go down, scale goes up. This Gigafactory is only going to speed along the process. So by 2019, it's entirely feasible that Volkswagen will be able to create a vehicle that is exactly like what they're claiming.
That's very interesting.
So
I love how all this stuff is just moving so quickly now. And it feels like, this is just my perception, but I feel like it's been moving much faster as recent as within the last like year. I just seem to be, or maybe we're getting more media coverage. I don't know what it is.
I think it's a matter of technology being exponential. Like once something gets started, it starts slow. But then as more breakthroughs happen, as scale increases, it innovates at a geometric rate. Like all of a sudden you're hearing about a new thing every 8 months, then every 6 months, then every 3 months. Now it's like you're hearing something every other week. So, but 2019, I mean, it's entirely possible that most of the cars you look at in a dealership could be electric by then.
And I think going back to my previous point too, it's got to be partially because just the public is taking an interest in it, and therefore the media has to take an interest in this whole sector. So we're just seeing more coverage of it.
We are. I mean, we're seeing more coverage, but at the same time, things are getting faster.
Sure.
So it's kind of this critical convergence where discoveries are happening really quickly, and then media coverage is building up. And so we have this perfect storm of, look at all the shit that's going on. It's crazy. And people are very aware of that, and they're driving the rate of transition even higher, because as they see all this news coverage, it's like, well, I want one of those. When can I get one of those that's like $12,000? I want an affordable one. When's that going to happen? So with all these consumers suddenly having interest in wanting these products, every car company is now basically forced to work on it, whether they like it or not, because nobody wants to be the car company that doesn't have an electric car by 2020.
Yeah, I mean, at some point in the future, maybe not by 2020, because that's a bit early, but at some point,
you could be out
of business if you don't adapt.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, in order for more people to adopt electric cars, they have to come down in price, but we have to start now. Like, manufacturers have to start investing now in technology and making more and more of them, because then the governments will start, you know, the governments of the world will start taking notice, and then we'll start building infrastructure. That's already happening now in Canada. You know, we have charging stations that are popping up everywhere. There's talk about a long-term plan in Canada to have some kind of infrastructure across the country where you have these quick charging stations. So it has to happen. The electricity's there. We just need to, it's not that hard of a problem to solve. It's just a costly problem to solve because they have to install these stations.
Well, I mean, yes and no. Tesla has been building out their charger network for years now, and it's at the point where you could theoretically travel across all of North America without running out of juice.
Now, why couldn't any electric car plug into a Tesla charging station?
At the regular ones, yes, any of them could theoretically, as long as they use the same charging protocol. Yeah,
maybe I haven't been following it close
enough.
That's
one of the issues. Like, early gen used a really giant plug. Like, I think charging plugs have iterated several times. Although, I think as early as like 2 or 3 years ago, they kind of settled on, this is what it should be like, and let's make these universal charging stations that work with it. And in theory, any of the Tesla charging stations that aren't superchargers should work with any electric car, in theory. I'm not 100% certain on that, but it's definitely in everyone's best interest to adhere to the same standard, because otherwise you're going to end up with
insanity. That part is for certain. Yeah.
Like, we don't want what happens with smartphones to happen to cars.
No.
Welcome to Texaco. Do you have a Tesla Model S or Volkswagen Model 3? If you don't, you can't charge here. We don't want that to be the future.
So then what is the holdup then for building out this charging infrastructure? Is it just the money? What is the problem with the government actually doing this?
I think the problem is governments don't want to shell out the money until the product has reached critical mass. As in, they don't want to start building these things until there's actual demand for them.
But isn't this kind of a chicken egg scenario? Because it's like, well, in order for it to have critical mass, people won't buy the cars if they know that they're going to run out of juice while driving it.
Right. But governments are greedy and tight-fisted, and they're not going to spend money that they don't have to.
Oh, please tell me more.
So, I mean, in the words of Young Justice, Earth to Megan, hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not going to build these things until people are screaming at them to build these things.
Yeah.
It's just the way it works, unfortunately. But that's why we have companies like Tesla filling in the gaps. So, I mean, at this point, it's not incredibly painful to own an electric car. You could own one. And as a huge benefit, if your car happens to be a Tesla, it has pretty much every charging station pre-programmed into its map. So it can actually plot a route that takes into consideration your charge level and where the nearest charging stations are. So it can go, okay, you want to go here. Well, you need to drive this far and then stop at this station and then keep going. It'll factor that right into the route planning. So I don't know if every electric car has this. So that's kind of a segue into the next big thing with cars, which is where Apple's going to come in as well, and that's software. So, like it or not, software is eating the world, and cars are no different. Right now, car software and integrated hardware is shitty. It's incredibly, incredibly shitty. The UIs are terrible. The features are scatterdash. Like, some cars will have this, some cars will have that. There's no uniformity. There's no, like, you can't just buy any car and expect to get the same experience from your entertainment center. So looking down the road, I think we're going to enter this period of car integrated hardware and software becoming uniform, reaching a place where instead of the car companies making it, it's going to be Google, it's going to be Apple, it's going to be Microsoft. And they're going to provide these integrated solutions that provide a uniform feature set for all cars. And they'll probably have onboard cellular access, the whole package. And this is going to happen sooner than later, I'm betting. Probably no later than 2020, we're going to start to see a shift in this as Apple develops CarPlay, as Google develops Android Auto, that's what they call theirs. So, I mean, as these systems develop, it's going to be a hop, skip, and a jump to, well, at the same time, now we've made this ARM chip that you can just put into your car and we'll bundle it with the software, and then your car can do all the same things people's smartphones can do. And that'll be really appealing. So before you know it, every car will basically either be an iPhone or an Android, although when it comes to Apple, my bet is it'll either be an Apple car or nothing, because that's kind of how they operate. I don't foresee any kind of large scale licensing for their software. They might do partnerships with high-end luxury brands. Like, I could see an Aston Martin having Apple software embedded in it, or like a Mercedes or a BMW. Like, those are all potential partners for Apple, because what Apple is to consumer electronics, they are to cars. So it's kind of a natural symbiosis there. But yeah, it's not clear exactly what they'll do, but overall the ecosystem is going to move towards car manufacturers no longer being in control of that part of the car, because people are going to start demanding more from their cars.
Just like we have done with our smartphones.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and the thing is, once the first car comes out that does this stuff, once the first iPhone of cars comes out, people are not going to be able to stop themselves from demanding the same features on any car they look at. And so that market pressure will force the car companies to buy in, essentially. So the danger with that is if everything is interchangeable and uniform, the actual car part starts to become sort of a race to the bottom for pricing, because it's like, well, I can buy any car and get my Android Auto dashboard. So why would I buy this one that's $15,000 when I can get this one for $10,000? So I think we might also see a race to the bottom in terms of car prices.
I think that's inevitable.
Yeah. Because, I mean, cars, it's like...
I think there will always be the luxury vehicles, though.
I think so, yes.
Because I think even with autonomous vehicles, there will always be things to differentiate them other than the fact that they drive themselves, whether it's luxury interiors. I think a lot of the same types of selling points, add-ons, things that that people are accustomed to now, you know, there's no reason why somebody wouldn't want to spend more money on a premium interior or premium sound system.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, things like that will still obviously continue to be options. Yeah. But once the dashboard of the car, once the amenities in the car become fairly uniform, it ceases to be about brand loyalty. It ceases to be about...
Are you saying that vehicles will become a commodity like phones at some point?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, as you say, luxury brands will still continue to survive, but there will be a compression of the market where the low to mid end is concerned. Like, we'll basically see something akin to the current Android OEM situation. Like, we'll end up with a handful of car manufacturers that all make Android Auto cars, or whatever ends up being the standard there. And those cars will all fight for market share, and the prices will go down. They'll start making things out of cheaper components just to try and drive the price down. And we'll end up with a Huawei car that costs $5,000. Like, I don't know.
I shouldn't knock it. There's nothing wrong with that. Just like there's nothing wrong with inexpensive, or should I say cheap, cell phones, because there is a need for those lower end products in certain countries.
Yeah. I mean, some people, a car is survival. Like,
right.
They need to get to their jobs. They need to drop their kids off at school. Like, it's a necessity.
From point A to point B. Like, you know, a lot of people don't have the same types of values that I have, where I like power, I like, you know, performance, I like luxury. And a lot of people just don't give a crap about that stuff. And that's fine.
Yeah.
There is a market for that.
Yeah. And I mean, this commodification will end up helping those people, because in a race to the bottom, the price conscious always win, because the price goes down.
Well, I mean, obviously, just look at what happened in retail with Walmart and what they did with their aggressive buying power and what they did to pricing out everybody else.
Yeah.
Including some of the, not just the smaller, I mean, the smaller businesses were the first ones to go, but even a lot of other big box retail stores are now really struggling with against Walmart.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, of course, as self-driving starts to take over, the commodification will turn into, well, why do I need a car at all when I can just subscribe to the shared fleet and get cars to pick me up and drop me off? Why do I even need to own a car at that point? And that'll happen too. And, it's hard to feel incredibly confident about investing in a car company for the next 20 years or so. Let's put it that way.
Financial crisis of 2008, the only reason why the government bailed out General Motors, it was because the economy would have been obliterated without car manufacturing, right? But it's not like they did it reluctantly, but...
No.
I mean,
no,
people
I mean,
know
they,
what the, where the problems are.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously this is a different thing, but yeah, like ultimately within the next 20 years, we are going to see a massive upheaval of the car industry. Companies will go bankrupt and crash. Other companies will be the next BlackBerry, where they're just making these cars that they think people want, but nobody wants them anymore, and then they just sort of fade away. There will be an Apple. It might even actually be Apple. Time will tell. And there will be a Samsung of cars as well. Somebody that makes decent mid-tier cars that have the features everybody wants, but don't necessarily look amazing, like good enough kind of thing. Like I think we'll basically see extreme parallels with what happens to cars in what is currently happening to smartphones. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to like that. It's going to be a mess for a lot of different areas. Jobs will be lost. But as the tireless march of progress goes on, I feel like this is just a series of events that is fated to occur. Like, it just seems inevitable that things will kind of head down this road, just looking at what's currently happening. Yeah.
Doom and gloom scenario by
well,
Michael.
I wouldn't say it's doom and gloom. Shit's gonna get crazy, but by the end of it, we'll have cheaper cars that go further without paying for gas. And then we'll get access to tens of thousands of self-driving cars.
Yeah,
further down the road than that.
The TLDR of this entire conversation is you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. And unfortunately, we need to break a lot of things about our old ways of thinking.
Yeah, it
and our old ways of making.
I mean, yeah, it's essentially an industry that's long overdue for disruption, and yeah,
well,
that disruption is going
lazy.
To be painful.
They're being lazy. Not just cars, but like the fossil fuel industry in cahoots with
exactly.
car manufacturers.
So, I mean, their MO has kind of been maintaining the status quo, right? So every year they just kind of turn out a car that's exactly the same as last year's car, maybe with a few extra bells and whistles, but it's effectively the same vehicle. I mean, they try to improve fuel efficiency, but that can only get you so far, and you're still emitting greenhouse gases.
They have me. I mean, across the board, with all the restrictions that are rules that they've put in place. You know, when the Obama administration came in about fuel economy, they have met a lot of those goals, and they have made a lot of improvements. If you add up all the fuel economy improvements over the last 10 years, even in trucks, it's actually pretty substantial. Like it's noticeable. However, I do believe, I do agree with you. I think there is a point of diminishing returns where it's like, okay, we can only take a petrol engine so far.
Yeah.
Like we can only make fuel injection so efficient. Like, yeah, we can do things like turn off cylinders, but at some point,
yeah, like we're not going to get to the point where an engine can run on like literal microscopic fuel vapor.
Yeah,
like,
it's just not going to happen.
Like, like you cannot, you're not going to be able to spray an aerosol into your engine and have it run for
exactly.
2 hours straight. Like, it's just not going to happen. So, yeah, I mean, not only is oil a finite resource, but engines that run on it are only going to become so efficient. Meanwhile, power efficiency from batteries, sky high room for improvement. I mean, we're at 300 or 400 miles now. Imagine what we could do 5 years down the road with capacity and charging time and all of that. Like a Tesla from 2021 or 2022, it could be like 600 miles range and charge in 10 minutes.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
From 0 to 100.
We're gonna get there too, and I think it's gonna happen sooner than later.
And at that point, it's like, why the hell am I buying a gas car?
That will be a legitimate question people will ask at one point.
Yeah. Like, once these cars exist and once they hit the price point that a majority of people want, who's going to want gas anymore? Nobody. Like, once you can buy a $10,000 car and go 300 or 400 miles on a single charge, like... It's a way, way better value proposition than having to fill up 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah.
So, and that's just because of the chemistry of batteries. Like, the energy density is hundreds of times higher than gas.
You know, the biggest concern that I always hear from people is that, oh, you know, even Tesla cars that go, I think, well, I mean, what's the largest capacity that Tesla has for their battery? Is it like 300 kilometers or something like that you can go on a single charge?
They actually just unveiled the Model S 100D, which is now the fastest production electric vehicle. It can go from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds.
Yeah, I heard about that.
The same as cars, up to twice its price.
But battery life.
How
many kilometers? I think they listed in miles, I think.
Yeah, I think the 100D goes up to 450.
That's pretty good. That's quite a range.
Yeah.
But the biggest complaint, going back to what I was saying, is I always hear from people, well, if I'm in an electric car, it can only go a couple hundred of kilometers before I can't go on a long distance trip before. But I always ask them, I'm like, you have a gas car. Do you not stop to fill up gas? The answer is yes. Well, with electric cars, at some point you will have to stop to charge. And if there are charging stations across the entire West Coast, if you wanted to drive down to California from Vancouver, it's not going to be an issue because maybe halfway on your trip, you'll have to stop for 15 minutes and get a quick charge, and that'll get you to the rest of your destination.
Yeah.
In fact, you'd probably have to fill up way more times with a petrol vehicle because you don't get the same kind of efficiency.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, it's not even a contest. That's the sad thing about this. Like, electric cars are just better, period. They will be able to go faster, go longer, charge quicker, and
instant torque.
Yeah. Like,
you don't have gears.
And
you don't have to wait for things to spool up.
Incredibly quiet, instant start, no backfiring in the engine because there's no engine.
Burning oil's gone. Bad smells are gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it solves so many problems.
Yeah. Like, it's essentially better in every single way. Every single way. And
except the only thing I'll miss is the rumble and roar of a big V8 engine.
And they can fake that with sound effects.
Yeah, it's not the same.
They have to do that, like, by law.
They've tried to do that on other vehicles. I think BMW tried to do that.
Well, no, like,
Top Gear ended up saying it didn't. The engine effects didn't sound good.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. But it is a genuine safety concern. Like, I think several countries have it on the books that electric cars have to emit some kind of sound.
Right.
For blind people or people that are impaired so that they know a car is coming.
Top Gear joked years ago when electric cars first started to sort of become popular, where, like, you know, you'd be driving, you know, you'd be like some kid will be in some quiet village and then all of a sudden they'll cross the street and then poof, they're just dead instantly because they didn't hear the vehicle. But there's road noise, there's tire noise, right?
There is, but...
But they are very quiet. It is a valid concern, though, because they kind of just make a whooshing noise.
Yeah, or like...
Yeah, there's some electrical noise, I think.
Yeah, like, it's very slight, though. So, I mean, someone hard of hearing isn't going to be able to hear it. So that's why, like, there are mandates in several states and several countries where it's like you have to have some kind of artificial engine noise or something so that people know a car is driving by.
Well, that won't help deaf people, but...
Well, yeah, but if... if they're not blind, they'll be able to see that's the
true.
Car.
They can see the lights. That's very true. So we've been talking about this for half an hour. We should probably move on to some of the other topics that we yes. wanted to talk about, because I know yes. that you wanted to get to No Man's Sky, which I have not played, but I've heard that they've had a massive drop, in active players. And now they're getting a lot of flack because apparently they've had to patch it a lot. There have been stability issues. And then I've seen some very interesting conversations on Twitter from like people that are designers saying that this is just flat out not a well-designed game, that there just isn't that much in there to keep you engaged. This open world concept is just too broad, and there's just like there's no plot. And people, I think, just it's becomes a novelty at first, and it's impressive at first. And that's my impression of it, is that it just kind of fades away.
Yep, that about sums it up.
Now, have you played it?
I have. So, yes, you start playing No Man's Sky, and you're like, wow, I am on a planet that's the size of a real planet, and it would take me quite a while to fly around it. Then you go into space and you're like, wow, this is really a solar system. There's multiple planets. It takes me actual time to get to another planet. Then you warp to another star system and another.
I think it sounds too much like a simulator. And simulators aren't that, they don't sell that well. They're not that popular. They become boring because they're too real. Like, well, I think the big mistake was not weaving in some kind of plot thing in
there
it.
There is sort of. It's just not very well defined. Like, there is some story in there. There are elements of things in there. There is a path you can follow.
Now, they can, I guess, patch it. They can release an update and add.
Oh, sure. They can add
things
stuff
to it.
But the issue here is that the damage has kind of already been done. So, and this could or could not be on Sony.
Well, a lot of people seem to be blaming Sony for the mishandling of the way the game was marketed.
Yeah.
There was so much mystery about
The thing is, Sony was extremely hands-off, and I don't think they should have done that because, and this is true, Sean Murray, the lead at Hello Games, the effective creator of No Man's Sky, essentially ran his mouth off for 2 years about how it would do everything and have all kinds of stuff in it, and you could meet other players, but it would be really rare, and all this other stuff would happen, and yeah, you can do that, you can do that. He would just, like, spout off on interviews about how incredible this game was going to be, and nobody stopped him. Nobody told him, hey, maybe you shouldn't promise things if they're not going to be in the game, or you don't think you're going to get to them in time.
Yeah, it's like you have to be careful about sounding so ambitious. Or when you set out on an ambitious project, that's fine. But just, you got to rope it back and be cautious about what you're going to promise to people.
Like, I think what they did was incredibly technically impressive. Like, it always gets thrown around a lot. Yes, it's a team of 15 people, really small. They came up with this amazing set of procedural algorithms to generate an entire galaxy of star systems. Really impressive, crazy scale. Yes, that is all true. But they forgot to put a game in it.
That's kind of a big deal, is it not?
Yeah.
Jesus.
So, I mean, the whole game just kind of feels like a really, really impressive half-finished tech demo where it's like, yes, there is absurd scale here. You can fly and fly and fly and fly.
I don't think anyone is questioning that, though.
Never see every planet. That is completely true. But when you drill down into the fine details of what you actually do in that galaxy, it's all the same stuff over and over again.
See, I feel this would have worked better as a PlayStation VR title.
It's possible, but ultimately people would get just as bored of it.
VR, so it needs story, people.
VR requires an active experience, and I don't think No Man's Sky is an active experience. It's a very passive experience. It's like, let's fly around all these cool planets and harvest these exact same resources and go to these samey space stations and trade goods and then rinse and repeat. And it just feels incredibly hollow and stale.
Like, it's a very damning statement to make.
It's, yeah, like, it's incredibly disappointing to me because it feels like they spent so much time focusing on building this massive galaxy that they didn't really bother to look at the minutiae of, okay, great, we've got 17 quintillion planets. What the fuck do people do on them? Like,
they're selling people on the features, but not the benefits.
It's so frustrating because it's like, they did this really amazing, impressive thing. And yet at the same time, it's just not fun.
It's not enough though.
Yeah.
That is not enough.
No, it isn't. And it's especially not enough for a $70 game, which is why people are so mad, because they were promised this incredible game that was like no other game that had ever been done before. And what they got was 17 quintillion planet simulator 2016.
They just threw these features. That's the problem. They sold customers on the features and not what the actual, they didn't even explain what the benefits were of actually like playing this. And on top of that, it's just, this is great. This is serious. Like, this is fascinating to me, but also I can't even imagine how many hours they spent on developing this and how many millions they probably had to spend on developing this game.
And their studio got flooded and Sony, like, had to bail them out.
And it sounds like they were arrogant.
Well, I don't think they were arrogant. I think they were just incredibly naive about what they could pull off.
But like, to me, there's arrogance in that, oh, we're going to make this thing that is just going to, like, it'll be nothing like you ever saw before, and it'll destroy everything else, and it'll be like this experience. Like, they're setting the expectations so high that they think that this experience is going to be so unique. It's like, we've had simulators before, but you also need story.
Yeah.
And they didn't deliver.
And I mean, not just that, but they didn't even deliver on like the emergent gameplay that they claimed they were going to have. Like, there was talk of a faction system, how you'd like earn reputation with these groups throughout the galaxy, and that you could aid them in battles and stuff, and other stuff would happen.
Well, that would have been good.
But it basically just boils down to some extra dialogue options when you talk to traders in space stations or outposts.
Oh, whoop-de-doo.
And
that's worth $70 there, right there.
The random battles, nothing really happens.
So there's like, no actual fighting, like, you don't.
Well, there is fighting. Like sometimes if you linger too long, pirates will attack you.
Is that all AI stuff or other players or
it's
what?
It's AI.
Okay.
So randomly pirates may attack.
And players can't fight other players.
No, there's no multiplayer. They swore up and down that there would be, and that you could.
This sounds terrible.
Eventually meet another player.
None of this sounds interesting.
Like, this was one of the big things. Because, like, whenever they pressed Sean Murray, he would say, well, it's really, really unlikely. But yes, you could run into another player. But day of launch, two people managed to meet in the same system, on the same planet, in the same spot. Didn't see each other at all.
See, I'm wondering if maybe the fact that there's, like, I get to convey the isolation of space, that could be important as a story, like, as an element to a story.
Well,
but if you never meet any, if that's all you do is you're just alone, I don't know. I would feel, well, that would make me feel alone and bored.
Yeah, like, I mean, technically you're not alone because you go to the space stations and the outposts and there's these, like, aliens and stuff, but that's it.
So do you like hunt and forage for like on planets?
Yeah, you have a mining laser and you can like mine resources from the planets.
And you upgrade your ship.
You upgrade your ship and you upgrade your mining laser thing. It's called an Omni Tool. And then you upgrade your suit, which can give you increased resistance to various
planets. So there is zero story in this game. Like there's no antagonist. There's no factions that are vying for power in this part of the galaxy. There's like none of that.
There's these three alien races and they sort of have limited backstories that basically cover who they are as a species. And then there's this kind of vague story about this chain of like hyper advanced AI things called Atlas. And I'm just going to go ahead and spoil it.
That's okay. Go right ahead.
So the ultimate goal of the game is to get to the center of the galaxy and see what's there. And then there's this thing where Atlas tells you to follow it, and you go to these various Atlas interfaces and get Atlas orbs or Atlas gems or whatever they're called. And if you get to the center of the galaxy and you have 10 of those gems, you go through a singularity and it recreates the galaxy. So it basically generates a new galaxy for you to explore. So there is
And then you rinse and repeat.
Yeah, there's basically no ending. You just go through the big shiny hole and, oh, look, there's more planets. That's it.
Yeah, I'm not going to bother with this game.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Not without...
I'm not spending like, $70 for that.
I think at this point they would basically have to stand up and say, okay, look, we fucked up. We thought we could deliver this amazing thing for you and we ran out of time and we're still really hard at work on delivering X, Y, and Z and we're going to have that out by Christmas. And we really hope to, like, I don't know, some bullshit statement that's like, we really hope to keep you as customers.
We like value your feedback. We value and appreciate your business.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they have to save face somehow.
Yeah.
Like, if they are legitimately working on adding features to the game, then tell people about it.
Well, communication is key. And I've talked about this, not on this podcast, maybe necessarily, but just as like as someone who has worked in business and technology for a long time and who has to deal with customers is that communication is so crucial. Even when you screw up, that is what can make or break your relationship with your customers. And still I see businesses that just don't get it. They don't know how to do it. It's not actually that hard.
Nope. And the thing is, like, here it was handled really badly. Like, game comes out, people start complaining that features aren't in there. Hello Games is basically radio silence and just tweets, random tweets about how awesome the game is. And how many people are hitting the server at the same time. They didn't answer anything about, well, where's this stuff? Where's this stuff? So, yeah, I would totally understand if they were like, look, we were really focused on making this game and some of the features didn't make it in for launch, but we're working on getting those out. Like, if they said that, I would totally understand and be okay with that because that's how game development works sometimes. Sometimes you have to hit that ship date no matter what. You can't push it back. You have to ship those discs. And you have no choice but to pull content. And if that's what happened here, I get that. I understand that. I can sympathize with that. But if they're going to sit there and not say anything and pretend that everything's fine, like, there's no help for you, really.
No. Well, it'd be interesting to see how this kind of unravels and unfolds over the next couple of months. Because I think if they keep, if they do add content and if their user base keeps dropping I see something happening, like where Sony gives No Man's Sky away for free to PlayStation Plus members, just as a means of desperation to sort of subsidize the product and get people to actually like download the game and start using it.
I feel like Sony feels like they've spent enough money on this game.
Well, probably.
Like they marketed it like a AAA title. It's an indie game, but they marketed it like a AAA title, and it costs as much as a AAA title. Like, I think those are the two things that have really pissed people off the most, because fundamentally, yeah, it's an indie game. I would spend maybe $20 or $30 on it and enjoy that, because it's like really cool and they're doing interesting things, and I could see it being on Steam Early Access or something where they can keep adding features. But this was presented as a AAA completely finished game for $70, and like that is the point that people are really frustrated with.
I understand.
And
I'm with them on that.
I mean, it's hard not to be with them. But at the same time, I mean, as is typical for the gaming community, there is a lot of extreme vitriolic commentary being thrown around. Hello Games, I'm sure, has gotten death threats. Sean Murray personally, I'm sure, has gotten death threats over this.
Well, that it will never. Okay. Well, no, we'll never excuse that. That's inappropriate.
Yeah, like I'm sure.
Just don't play the game.
Happening.
If you don't like it, don't play the game.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure Sony will give you a refund if you send them an email. They don't usually, but I think in this case, it's probably justified. Yes, it's disappointing. Yes, it's frustrating. But don't start pulling out the swords over this.
It's not worth it. It's just a game, people.
Yeah.
Just a game.
Get your refund and calm down.
Just walk away. Walk away. Put the controller down.
Yeah.
All right, well.
So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. And, I mean, if nothing comes out of this that's positive, we will basically look back on this in the history books as, well, this is what happens when you overpromise severely and underdeliver. As well as, I think it's kind of a suicide note for procedural gaming. The whole concept behind this was that you could procedurally generate a ton of content and that it would be engaging, and it simply isn't. It proves that you really do need a team of dedicated artists and writers.
Well, that's where design comes
to make
in.
A game work. I think this was the big test for whether procedural could actually work as a full game, and it bombed completely.
I've never known anyone who's made any kind of convincing argument that is the case, that can be done. Procedural's fine on a small
scale. it can help extend things, but it definitely proves that you do still need the guiding hand of an art team and a writing team to make a game what it is. Like, I mean, proponents of procedural will argue, well, they obviously just didn't add enough variables and enough like random chunks of things. And maybe if they'd done that, it would have like been way better and more detailed. But it's like there are diminishing returns on that. And the more chunks you add, the more complexity is there and the more that can go horribly wrong. And you just end up creating something so unwieldy that you may as well have just designed a AAA game in the first place.
Tell me if this is unfair, but I feel like this whole thing of just completely relying on building this entire game around this procedural engine, this like completely inhuman robotic thing that just generates like shits out stuff. To me, this seems like a crutch for people that just don't want to actually design the game. Like really design how this plays with story and write stuff, write these characters and write how these characters interact with each other.
Yeah, like I would say this is a complete indictment of using it to make an entire game. but I think it can be very helpful in targeted ways. So like, let's say you have a game where it is in space and you enter a star system and there's this spaceport. To make it feel like super lived in and busy, you wouldn't necessarily want an art team to spend their time making 6,000 different unique ships that are flying in and out.
Of course not. That's not realistic.
At that point, procedural generation does make a lot of sense because then you can fill that scene with things that look unique but are really generated from a few core parts and variants that the artists have designed. Then you throw those into the engine and you say, okay, fill this space with 6,000 ships moving around.
Bam. Yeah, but that's obviously clearly very different. That's using it as an assistant rather than making it the focal point of your game.
Yeah, and I mean, that's where the indictment comes in. It's like, yeah, you cannot really make a full game out of this. It doesn't seem like it's possible.
It isn't, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, this just tried to do just that, and it doesn't work.
Nope.
I mean, yeah, you can make 17 quintillion planets, but you can't put really cool, interesting things on them. Because if you start from like these random seeds, and you only have so many things, and I mean, having played the game, I can say without a doubt this is true. It's like you end up with these planets that are incredibly samey. Like, oh, this is a green planet. Oh, this is a red planet. This is a blue planet.
Not all that exciting.
But the topography is all very similar. Like, it's all completely random, but at the same time, it's all completely similar.
That just makes it so much worse. At the very least, if they were so unique and so vastly different, at least that makes it interesting.
Yeah.
But it's not.
In practice, it's not.
See, and I had assumed that it would be.
Yeah. And so did a lot of people, I think. But the thing is,
probably why they want their money back.
Yeah, probably. I mean, with procedural generation, it's all about what you put into it. So if you only put a limited subset of things into it, of course it's going to generate things that look the same. Because you can only do so many random variants of like 5 different things before you start to see things that look exactly the same as the first thing it's spat out. So when you chalk that number up to 17 quintillion, I mean, maybe there are some really unique planets out there, but chances are the average player isn't going to see them.
You've been listening to The Impromptu on Hologram Radio. I'm here with Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for this podcast and our network at large, please go to patreon.com/hologramradio and join the other lovely people and become a regular donator, which is the single best way to support the work that we do. If you don't do anything else, please give a buck. Even a buck, it really does make a difference. And what we do here is fun, but it's definitely not free. We have things like server costs, hosting, bandwidth, all that sort of thing. So please give what you can. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast player of choice. But if you do use iTunes, please take a moment. And actually, even if you don't. Take a moment anyway. Leave us a rating in iTunes. If you leave us a decent rating, we'll give you a shout out on this podcast, well, on a future episode anyway. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I am at Zero Distraction. We're also on Facebook if you do a search for Hologram Radio. That's our network. And you can check out some of the other podcasts that are there. We've got a handful of other interesting podcasts like Covered, which is a podcast for writers. We've got The Right Gear, also another podcast for writers and about the tools and processes that they go through. And we also have the Gem Podcast, which is a podcast where we dissect every episode of Gem and the Holograms. And we have a few other shows that we're currently working on, which are top secret. We can't really talk about it right now, but do check it out. And if you'd like to send some feedback to Michael or myself, you can send it the old-fashioned way via email. Send that to theimpromptu@hologramradio.org. That's theimpromptu@hologramradio.org.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.